good afternoon and welcome to Noon Edition with co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. It is Friday, September 26th, and this week we are joined by some folks, both in studio and on the phone, who will help uncover the ways that universities craft their messages. Joining us this week on the phone, we have John Beacon. He is the Vice President for Enrollment Management at Indiana State University. In studio, DePauw University Media Relations Director Ken Owen and Indiana University Senior Associate Director of Public Affairs Angela Tharp. Thanks, everybody, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get started, it is my duty to point out there are a couple of ways you can submit your questions to our panel during the next hour. If you're near a telephone, you may want to write down these next two phone numbers. You can call us from the local area at area code 812-855-0811 or toll-free from anywhere at area code 877-285-9348. You can also email us a question now or anytime at noon@indiana.edu. So the first question I want to ask all of you is whether you believe in the saying that there is no such thing as bad publicity where the universities are concerned. Is this a truism in your minds?
No.
That would be a unanimous no.
Yeah. I'd be happy to jump in on this. No, there are I guess even in the worst of situations in a university setting, it does provide you an opportunity to state who you are and what you're about. So there can be some positives that come from extreme negatives. But no, there are some times that – and many times that you are very happy not to be the subject of a news report. It can be a squirrely business. No, I think even if you're suffering from a reputational drought, if you're a school – and none of the schools here today are in that situation. But if you're in a situation where you just need to get your name out, having something very unsavory happen on your campus or being associated with such a thing is never a positive.
And I think when those kinds of situations occur, dealing with it honestly and directly and taking the initiative at the beginning sometimes deflates some of the possible ramifications that can come from not acting fairly promptly.
So I'm curious to know whether you think the size of a school's student body or its alumni base matters in terms of how a message is crafted. In other words, here we've got one very large school, one very small school, and one school that's in the middle of those two. And I'm wondering about your place in the university food chain, as it were. How do you craft your message with regard to the size of the school, if at all? Angela, we'll start with you. I mean, 40,000 students here, hundreds of thousands of alumni with whom you have to communicate. Does that make a difference to you in terms of the just largesse of the numbers?
I think it absolutely makes a difference. It can certainly be challenging. The fortunate thing is that even though I'm in the central office and we actually serve all eight campuses, I have a lot of colleagues out there in individual units and on the various campuses who are there to assist. And, you know, certainly we have a lot of strong sub-brands, not just the big Indiana University brand. And so I think all of those things together really complement each other and make our brand and make our image. But it is incredibly challenging sometimes to be able to communicate effectively when you have such a big system. So I think that requires a lot of systems in place to be able to work collaboratively with your colleagues and make sure that you have some central messages at the top, which are then reinterpreted in individual units for their specific target audiences.
Right. You've got so many audiences. You've got alumni, students, parents, even legislators who decide funding to some extent, donors, sports fans. I think each – do you try to tailor your message to accommodate each one of those audiences?
I think so. I think – and obviously some messages are going to be more pertinent to one audience over another. But I think especially when it comes to the area of student recruitment, we are very different schools and there are many, many schools in this country. I think one of the jobs we have is to cut through the clutter and to show people why we are different. I really believe if you got 10 students in a room and you offered them 10 different college opportunities, you might find that each one has a different feel for what their best fit is. So one of my jobs is to let people know that if you come to DePaul University, you're going to be in a class that might have 9 or 12 students in it with a professor. There are no teaching assistants. That if you come to campus and want to play football and also be in the musical and sing in the choir and perhaps work on the student newspaper, you can do that from day one. So we each have unique experiences we offer. And I think one of the things that we need to do is like a constant drumbeat in the night, just let people know that this is the place to come if this is something that appeals to you.
I've been in this business exclusively for more than 40 years, and I think I've survived in this business because I've never looked at a student in particular as a dollar sign. I think the right fit is critical to this, as Ken was talking about. There's a million reasons not to choose a particular school. A student should never be selecting schools because their girlfriend or boyfriend's going there, or their best friend's going there, or their parents are alumni, or their school counselor told them that's the place to go. And I think that there's a lot involved with selecting a school, and not every school, obviously, is perfect for every student. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of having the three of us on today, because we really do represent three very different institutions. And I never look at it as that we're in competition with one another. I see us disseminating information to students for them to make the best decision. I never want to make a decision for a student because then I'm responsible for it, and that's the last thing I ever want to be.
Now, do you each have in mind, this is the kind of student that we're trying to attract when you craft your message?
Oh, I think if I can continue that. Certainly, I think a lot goes into looking at student characteristics and profiles. When I started in the admissions, we were all gatekeepers back in the 60s and 70s, and it was really a matter of just sorting out students. This business has become very sophisticated, very market-oriented. We do a lot of analysis in terms of the right student for the right fit, and a lot of our early connections with students are driven based on those profiles. We buy search names, for example, as I'm sure all of us do, based on certain anticipated fits of students. It's not a perfect science, nor should it ever be a perfect science, but it helps us to sort through a little bit.
I have, in the course of my job, actually no lord over admission publications and the kind of messaging they do. Mm-hmm. So the kind of messaging I do to prospective students largely is through our website and via the news we put up there. And I think that if you read the messages as a whole, you'll see that most students that come to DePaul University are engaged from the beginning. They've been in leadership roles in their high schools, and I think that would permeate the conscience of a young student as they looked at DePaul. Again, as Jan said, there are some students that just aren't the right fit for each of our schools, and it's no slap against them. I mean, obviously, there are many, many different attributes that go into kind of deciding what a college experience should be, and it's a very individual and personal thing. But I know our admission folks spend a lot of time through their publications and the folks that they work with on those in that arena, and yes, that is very important.
And I think that our admissions folks also spend a great deal of time trying to get people to our various campuses, because there's nothing that is going to help these students understand what is going to be the best fit for them other than having that experience on campus, being able to interact with professors, being able to talk to those admissions counselors about what the school can offer.
Mm-hmm. And this may be on your list of questions for today. If I can just jump in, Angela, and say if there's one takeaway for parents I hope we leave after an hour with, it's that with U.S. News and World Report and Forbes and Princeton Review and God knows how many other publications out there now ranking schools, mm-hmm. it's really important to keep your eye on the individual needs of your student. And for students, not just to look at number one and say that's best or number four is better than number six. The number one film at the box office this year or this week won't necessarily be the one we're talking about in 40 years. So you really have to make a personal decision, visit campuses, and decide what do you want out of a college experience. Maybe you want to go to a Big Ten football game every week. Maybe being in a small classroom isn't your cup of tea. But look at the things that you value And don't just rely on a number somewhere and you know, check some boxes and make a choice long distance.
And let me echo what both of my colleagues have said. And I think any student needs to ask themselves, what is it that you want from the college experience? And the pieces that come together in that analysis are the size of the institution, the location, cost, whether it's urban or rural, how academically challenging the student wants it to be. Name recognition actually plays a role in that, as do extracurricular activities and how involved students are going to be. But it all comes down to what I heard just a moment ago, and I think maybe Angela said that, and it is getting them to campus is absolutely critical. A lot of it is driving students to the web today because this millennial student is very, very comfortable with that sort of analysis of an institution, at least initial analysis, but we always want them to take some action based on having taken a look at us, and that is to come and see the campus, because it's truly on a campus visit that I think students can really determine whether this is the right fit for that particular individual or not.
John, I wanted to ask you, you've got sort of the medium-sized school in here. How do you market yourself against – you've got, you know, larger competitors like Purdue and IU that have that big school feel. Then there are many, many small schools also in the state. And here's ISU right in the middle. How do you differentiate yourself, and how do you sell being in the middle?
Sure. And I think from our perspective, and my colleagues probably wouldn't – I wouldn't expect them to agree with us, but our niche is being sort of in the middle. We, I think, provide the best of both opportunities. We are one of the four research universities in the state of Indiana. We're the smallest of those. So for the student that's looking for a public education at a research comprehensive institution where there's lots of choices, they can find that at Indiana State University, where still the classes are relatively small, and our costs are fairly competitive. So we're really sitting, I feel, from a marketing perspective, in a pretty good place.
I have an issue that I'd like each of you to address specifically. Angela, I'll start with you. Recently, there were seven IU students who posed in Playboy magazine. And admittedly, we live in a pretty conservative state. And there have been a few people who have said they weren't sure if this is the kind of way that they want IU and its students to be portraying themselves. And I'm wondering, is it still better to have a mention of IU in the magazine, regardless, in this case, of its context in its, you know, purest form?
No. No, I really don't think so. I think it goes back to what Ken was saying at the beginning, that you know, not all publicity is good publicity, and we'd prefer not to have our name associated with that sort of thing at all. On the other hand, we're dealing with a large collection of young people who are adults, and they're going to make the decisions that they want to make. So even though we are concerned about our image and reputation as Indiana University, they have the right to be who they want to be and to display themselves as they want to display themselves, so long as they're not violating any of our specific policies. But no, I would personally prefer that we not have our name associated with that.
And I would say, Angela, I think the toughest things we deal with are probably those situations in which students misbehave or do things that we wish they hadn't done, only because it reflects on the kind of students we tend to admit. Mm-hmm. And though it's one thing if the Princeton Review puts you on the party school list, because we can all stand in front of people and without breaking into a lie at all, test the methodology of the Princeton Review and basically take it apart as made up, which is essentially what it is. But when our students cross the line, it's very difficult. And yet, you know, when you join the Elks Club or you join the Neighborhood Association, you really have no control over what the other members of that organization do. And in any community, there are people who are going to cross the line and make mistakes. And part of the educational process, I think, is to make a mistake and learn from it. We've all done it. So I think that these things all pass, and in terms of what the students did with Playboy, you know, it's a decision they made, and many of them consulted with family members, and life goes on. It's the more serious situations that tend to have longer term ramifications that bother you. But yes, I think at a certain point, the university has to distance itself from student behavior, but at the same time provide a mechanism to support students and to help them in times when they've perhaps made choices that are drawing attention to them that they feel uncomfortable with over time.
I do think, though, you made a really good point that, you know, this is the kind of thing that's short-term. And I don't think that we as an institution can get too caught up in those kinds of things that are going to come and go. The bottom line is, yes, we might be on the front page of the newspaper and we don't like it, but that's for a day. And there are a lot of people who are cleaning up their cat poop with that with that paper. So I think that we can place a little too much importance sometimes on how big these kinds of negative publicity are.
We also I do have opportunities periodically to say no before things occur, and that's through sponsorships. We're probably all contacted. I can think of some pageants that have requested sponsorship to be hosted on the campus. And those are the kinds of things that we can say. We really would rather pass on that. We don't think that's an appropriate way for us to be spending our money or marketing the university if we don't think that it fits into our marketing plan.
It is always nice when we're asked first, isn't it?
It is.
Oh,
it really is.
How rare those opportunities are.
And that actually leads into my question for John, which is that, you know, a report earlier this year placed ISU, and I suppose I should mention DePauw, on the same list that said that they were two schools in some of the most boring places in the country to go to school. And, you know, Ken said that the methodology is sometimes derided.
Sometimes.
and so I'm wondering, how do you handle a list like this whose creation you cannot control?
There's certainly – that's absolutely true. There's certainly some control over which we have no control. That wasn't well said, but that, you get what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think that we always have the opportunity in marketing to promote what's particularly good about our community. I know that Terre Haute has suffered in the past from not being close to a large metropolitan area, but Terre Haute is truly a place where there's a lot of things going on. And in fact, we're talking right now about linking our website to some of the more interesting activities that are available. And in fact, this time of year in Terre Haute, from now through the end of October, virtually every weekend, there are festivities going on. There's an art festivity going on this weekend, and there was a jazz festivity a couple of weeks ago, and it's family weekend and around a football game. So we need to do a better job than we've done perhaps in the past of promoting those kinds of things. But like any community, I think that if people are interested, they can find things to do that are fun and exciting.
Absolutely, John. And in Greencastle, we just in the town, in the city, received from the Indiana Association of Cities and Towns the Green City Award, which we're sharing with Bloomington for this year. Greencastle is becoming a more vibrant place. The mayor, Sue Murray, is diligent and working very hard at bringing the community and the campus closer together. So there are a lot of things happening. I think that, again, if you look at the Princeton Review, and I don't want to spend more than a minute on this, but it shows on their website that every 3 years they do a survey. They put a book out every year. So two of those years, they're either relying on old data or just essentially making it up. And they also will not share with any of us how many students they query. Also, until very recently, and this still may be the case, I could get on there and log in as a student and say, I just find this town vile. And, you know, this campus community is terrible and the professors are boring. I mean, even if I'd never even stepped foot on that campus. So I think, again, consumer beware. It's great that we have these kind of dialogues. But at the end of the day, if you're publishing something and it's not fact-based and if you won't share the methodology with the end user, I'm not sure it's a valid instrument.
Ken, isn't that even an opportunity to kind of work? I mean, we talk about spinning things. I mean, I can see how you could spin that to parents and say, yeah, you know, maybe this isn't a big metropolitan area, but there's a lot going on at our school.
Yeah, we do occasionally in our jobs have to do a bit of that spinning stuff. But I think this is one of those times where and I'm a real believer in full disclosure and just lay it all out. This is one of those times where you just tell people this is how this survey, or if you want to call it that, is put together. And I think it gets back to what we were talking about at the beginning, and that is the parents and the students need to come to the community mm-hmm. and see if they're comfortable there. And just to throw a dart on the board and say Akron, Ohio is boring without having been there is really unfair to everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. And I think every college town, every college city suffers from this to some degree. I mean, if you look at Indiana University's 8 campuses, sure, we have a campus in Indianapolis, the biggest city. We have Bloomington, which I think inside the state of Indiana is considered a really wonderful place to be. I mean, I was actually saying before this show that last week I had the opportunity in the course of 4 days to listen to Nina Totenberg, to go to a concert with Josh Bell, and to hear Madeleine Albright. 4 days, mm-hmm. all of it completely free. I mean, mm-hmm. that's pretty incredible. With that said, however, there are plenty of out-of-state students who have the perception that Indiana is podunk. And so it doesn't really matter that we have these incredible opportunities here if they don't know about them. And I would have to say that instead of spinning, our job in many respects is informing mm-hmm. people accurately. Mm-hmm. about what we offer.
And if I could just piggyback, I'm sorry, John, to jump in here, but we had Madeleine Albright last week and Lee Hamilton, and we have Tony Blair in the spring. One of the things that really just upsets me, frankly, is when we have people like Tony Blair to campus and you walk out the door after the event and you see students out playing frisbee golf. I think those are some of the same students who may be among the 30 who fill out the survey every 3 years and check this place is boring. It's really what you make it. I think that every college environment has something to offer most of its students. And I'm frustrated sometimes by how few students avail themselves of those opportunities.
I've had the joy in my life of working at 8 universities in the last 40 years, from the University of Nebraska to Maine, and there's quite a variation in those institutions. But one of the things that I've never been disappointed in is in living in a college town, and I think Angela mentioned something about that, that there is something special about a college town, no matter the size of the university and what those colleges typically will bring, both in terms of athletic events as well as cultural events. You seldom have to travel very far, and you certainly don't have to pay normally what it would typically cost to attend some of these events in larger venues. So for me, it's just been wonderful, and I think the opportunities that have been opened up to my family, having had the experience of living in always college towns, has been far richer for us than it might have been had we lived in a town that wasn't filled with colleges.
My last question is for Ken before we take our break. Early in the decade, DePauw was sued by a professor who felt that her job description had been wrongfully, you know, decreased. That suit was eventually thrown out. But you spent an entire summer fighting the public relations about this with the people all the way up to Pat Robertson, on whose mm-hmm. program the story appeared. And from talking to you at the time, I know that you firmly believed in the university's case beginning to end, and in the end, your belief was proved correct. But I'm wondering what happens and maybe can you conceive of a case where your beliefs might not fall in line with what the university asked of you or what administrators in the university felt was best for DePauw's image? How would you handle that sort of, you know, that sort of internal battle?
I'm not sure I've had that happen yet. I'd really have to give that some deep thought. I know that I'm a pretty honest broker, and I suspect my colleagues are too. And I need to be a voice at the table when we're talking about how these issues are going to be dealt with publicly. I really, again, believe full disclosure is key. And I went to DePauw University, and I was on the alumni board for many years. And so I believe my values are pretty well in tune with DePauw University. So I've not really hit the wall in a case where I just felt that the president or the board of trustees or whoever was making a decision was, you know, off the reservation. And that's a good thing, because I think as a communicator, the key is that that you align with that which you are messaging about. And so in that area, I guess I'm very lucky, and I'm sure my colleagues feel the same way, that you really need to be a voice at the table as you start to discuss how you're going to talk about these things. And it's interesting that the things that tend to take up most of your time are these things where someone kind of starts a fire somewhere. And it's a small fire and it involves very few people, but it gets some attention from the outside. And we're in kind of a gotcha media culture where it's not really there aren't too many reporters out there doing stories about our schools of music or – you know, some of the really neat things our students are doing in terms of community engagement. They're really kind of interested in the quirky, offbeat, and usually unfortunate things that happen. And that's really sad because I think the story of higher education is not being told in the way it should be.
All right. Well, we have to take a break. We'll come back with the conclusion of this week's Noon Edition. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunstreet.info. If you're a person on the go, you can take WFIU programs with you. We're podcasting. Podcasting is a convenient and easy way to download audio files directly to your computer. Listen anytime from your computer, iPod, or portable player. You can download podcasts of full-length programs like Noon Edition, Ask the Mayor, and Harmonia, or short features like Kinsey Confidential, the Ether Game musical mini-quiz, and movie, play, and opera reviews. You can find out how with a visit to our website at wfiu.org.
Well, let's see.
We are back on Noon Edition. Joining us today on the phone, John Beacon from Indiana State University, DePauw University's Ken Owen, and Angela Tharp from IU. Thanks again for being here. A reminder, you can ask some questions of our panel if you like. Call us at area code 812-855-0811 or dial us toll-free if you're listening to us on the internet, for example, at 877-285-9348. You can also email us at noon@indiana.edu. Now, one of the ways that it occurs to me that you can craft the message is by granting or indeed limiting access to high-ranking officials. What goes into that sort of decision-making process about when the president should answer something or when he or she should stay away from a subject?
You're actually the media specialist.
Well, I pointed at Angela because I've been yapping too much. I think it's really important and I'd be curious to hear what everybody else thinks that you really limit your president's exposure to especially sticky situations. We had the Delta Zeta case last year involving the national leaders of a sorority came in and essentially told some women they could no longer be members, and the end result was that the sorority was lost its ability to have a house on campus. I really thought it was important that we waited until there was kind of a final determination to put our president in front of the media and that happened once. And we had a news conference. There was a satellite truck. It was available. The clips were available on our website if radio stations wanted to pull them down. And, of course, we ended the news conference and an hour later the Oprah Winfrey Show called and ABC News wanted him to come on Good Morning America. Mm-hmm. But we were done. And I think it's really important that you put a boulder down and say, this is the time we're going to talk about this. We'll answer all your questions and then we're over it. And the president has much bigger fish to fry than to deal with ongoing kind of, you know, media squabbles or they're saying this. And so I think it's really important that you let your president be the president. And I think my job is essentially to be an offensive lineman and not block people out of his way, but try to let him do what he does and yet – continue to be the spokesperson for the university in times when his voice is really important.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a slightly different tack and say that we have a new president at Indiana State University, and we're all getting to know him, having had him on campus for a little over 4 or 5 weeks. And we've asked him that question, how involved does he want to be? And I think one of the things that's perhaps a little unique about our president is he has moved back onto campus, and so can hardly help but be pretty visible. We had a fire on campus on one of our high-rise resident halls that happily was contained very quickly, but it displaced a few students for a few days. And that, as an example to him, it was one of the things that he said he would see the value in being involved. I think he wants to be in front of the parents saying that things are under control, things are fine, and he sees that as his responsibility. So it's something of a shared responsibility. We certainly don't want to put him, as you said, Ken, he's got far too many other important things to be doing, but this he sees is also very important because students are number one, and he feels that his involvement and engagement in those kinds of issues is critical.
Let me clarify just a bit, John, too. We have a new president who's been there 2.5, 3 months, and he is an excellent communicator, and I would have no trepidation about putting him in front of anyone in any situation. I think that the key is that now we had a fire, too, and I agree, having the president there and having him up here on the website talking about, you know, the student safety and the fire department did a great job, that's all very, very valuable. That was back in 2002. But I do think that when you're dealing with ongoing situations, the DZ thing started in December and basically went through April, May. Mm-hmm. I think you really, especially early in the process, have to, whether it's the vice president for students or whoever it is, find people who are not the president who can answer all the picayune questions that emerge. When you finally get to that moment where you're going to put the thing to bed, when you've made a decision as a university, I think that's the time to bring the president out because it can become the president's issue. And I think that can be very dangerous too.
And I take your point well. And I was using a totally different example. And my example was one where I think it was important to have the president have a presence and be the spokesperson for the university. So they are different situations. And it was something that was handled very quickly. It was important to get on the air very quickly and reassure the parents of our students that everything was fine.
I want to get to a couple of phone calls real quick. Betsy is on the phone. Betsy, thanks for calling into Noon Edition.
Yes, hi. I'm sure you've all heard of the Amherst Initiative, which has
the
to do with drinking
Initiative
on campuses. Not so much lowering the age, but just discussing it. And I wondered how all of your three universities are handling that and what you think of it.
We at DePauw have not signed it, and that was largely due. That's not saying we would sign it, but the letter, the actual instrument, passed the president's desk as the presidents were having a Buckingham Palace changing the guard. Our old president, Bob Bottoms, our former president, now president emeritus, was leaving the office. The new president, Brian Casey, was taking over. I know that Dr. Casey views the issue of young people drinking as something that is obviously of extreme importance to all of us. But whatever solution, and I would not call lowering the drinking age a solution in and of itself, you really have to have a multi-tiered approach. It has to be part of a broad look at initiatives that help young people make decisions. And, you know, if students do choose to drink illegally right now, you know, universities have to be there to provide alcohol education. We can't turn our backs on the problem. So, but I think, Betsy, your point is, your question is, did we sign it? We did not. Are we looking at it? Yes. But I think it's got to be part of a broad look. And I think if you go to the Amethyst site, that's one of the things they're talking about. But I don't think that just lowering the drinking age is going to take care of the problem. There are many, many issues to address here.
And having had a new president at Indiana State University at about the same time, that was his decision as well not to sign. And I think for all the reasons that Ken has stated, that's where we are. And rather than spend the time to repeat what he's just said, I think that's exactly the position that Indiana State University has taken on this.
We have another phone call. Robert, thanks for calling Noon Edition. What would you like to ask our panel?
Yeah, I have a question. I don't have the figures in front of me, but all I'm reading is that the cost of college or college education has increased at a much greater rate than inflation for almost everything else. I'd like to know just why this is, and as a sidelight to that, at IU a few months ago or something, there was an article about both the students and the faculty were very upset that they might have to attend classes or have classes on Fridays. Would that have anything to do with it? I'll listen to your answers.
let me jump in as an old financial aid director along the path of my career and say that I've been interested. I can remember back in the 80s when federal funds to institutions were came in the form of grants to the extent of about 60%. Loans were around 40%. What's happened is that institutions have been forced to increase their costs as state appropriations and federal funding has changed. And we have not kept up with cost of living. And so as those appropriations have depreciated, we have just had to put the cost of education more on the backs of students. And it's not a happy place for us to be, but that's where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that there's been a shift in public opinion that many years ago it used to be that higher education was considered something that was a public good. And now I think it's considered very much an individual good, and therefore the individual should be the person that is primarily paying the cost of that education. Now, a lot of us may disagree with that, but I do think that that has influenced why we are where we are. In terms of costs at Indiana University, the one thing I can say is that certainly in the Big Ten, our costs are not increasing as much as many of our competitors, and that you know, one of the big studies that looked at Indiana University and other universities in terms of public accessibility put us in the top 30 for being one of the most affordable public institutions. So I certainly hear and feel your pain, because I think the cost of higher education is becoming beyond what many can afford. And I think that I think we have to look at this holistically. There are a lot of things that are leading to this issue.
How do you deal with that at DePauw, which is by far the most costly school that we're talking to on this panel today?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think that we're comparing apples and oranges. Private schools, as I'm sure the caller Robert realizes, have historically been more expensive than public schools. Public colleges and universities, actually, if you look at a bar graph over the past 3 or 4 years, the percentage increase at public universities is much greater than private schools. Now, private schools remain more expensive than public schools. I agree with Angela that we really have to look at our priorities as a society. Do we value the ability of people to get college degrees from all walks of life, and do we think government should be in the business of helping provide opportunities for people to attend colleges? I think that because of the issues that you're dealing with, you're dealing with obviously different dynamics than we are, but we're all having to pay more to heat our dormitories, more to provide food for our cafeterias and living units, and it's a tough environment. We're all paying it at the gas pump, and I empathize fully with Robert, because we're all consumers in this business. In the end, we're all sending people to college, our kids, our grandkids. These are very expensive propositions, and I think down the road, getting back to Angela's point, we need to have a real dialogue about what we value and what this is. But the second point I'd make about DePauw in particular is that there is the price that you see, which is in the $40,000 range, and the price that many people pay. There are very generous financial aid packages that weren't available even when I went to DePauw back in the 1980s. And I think it really behooves parents to, as they look at colleges, not be put off by sticker shock. What you see that you're paying at a given institution may not be what your child qualifies for by the time all the financial aid packages are put together. So don't just dismiss a school because it looks expensive. There are many, many quality schools in this country and many, many quality schools in this state when you start putting pen to paper, you realize the price difference isn't that great.
And two things that I might add, if I may, is the wonderful thing about this country and the wonderful thing about this program today is that you're hearing from three different schools. Students have choices. If transportation were the only thing we were interested in, we'd all be driving small, inexpensive cars. But the beautiful thing is that we can make choices. The average student that graduates from Indiana State University leaves with a loan indebtedness of $18,000, which is, in fact, less than the price of a small, compact car. And yet the investment over time, the reward and return on that investment over a lifetime of approximately $1.6 million more than a student who doesn't, or a person would have without a college education certainly shows that the investment is well worth the return.
And Robert, I actually did not answer the last part of your question, which was about Friday classes. And I don't have the sense that that has anything at all to do with the price tag.
I don't either.
I wanted to know if there, you know, in terms of crafting a university message, what are some of the big misconceptions that the three of you run into when you tell people what your job is and they say, oh, do you do X? And you're forced to say, no, I really do Y. What is that conversation like, and what are some of those things that people don't quite understand about how a university message is actually, you know, put together by the people who do it?
For one thing, for me, it's a constant work in progress. It's constant struggle because the markets are so tough, particularly in the northern tier of Midwestern states. We're not sitting in Florida, California, Texas, where and we're a very traditional institution, so the number of traditional students coming to our institutions, they have a lot of choices, and there's a lot of institutions, particularly even in Indiana. So we have to be very sharp in our marketing approaches. I like to think that the kinds of things that we're trying to do are cutting edge and that they're pushing the envelope. But it's also difficult at times to keep up with the various ways in which students are accessing information. It changes almost from month to month in terms of the way students are receiving information. And we have to be flexible enough to make sure that we are reaching them the way that they're accustomed to receiving that information and the way they want to receive it.
I just want students around the country to know that the intellectual life at DePaul University is rich and different, and that you have enormous opportunities if you come to our campus. And I think one of the things that we probably, getting back to the Indiana point, we all try to dispel, and it's a myth, is that Indiana is somehow some wasteland where nothing happens. And we have, again, great schools here with great opportunities. The ability to walk two blocks and hear Madeleine Albright or hear a performance is something you don't have on many campuses across the nation. So that's a drum we have to keep beating, too.
And you asked specifically about misconceptions about our own positions. And for me, one of the biggest challenges I face is that there's not a great deal of understanding about what marketing is, and there are all kinds of different definitions of that. And especially because marketing can be such an umbrella category, I think it really confuses people. I actually do an incredible amount of research when I'm able to do my job well. And so I think it surprises a lot of people that that we actually have people who are intensively looking at different target audiences and focus group testing concepts and doing quantitative studies to look at images and perceptions across the state of Indiana and beyond.
And I think at the end of the day, what we do is truth-telling. I think if we're doing our jobs well, we're really bringing to the front, to people's attention, what it is that our institutions do. Mm-hmm. I think that the cynics would look at us and think we're selling bug spray or, you know, air fresheners or something. You mm-hmm. know, this isn't Madison Avenue marketing. This is basically saying, if you come to this campus, here are the experiences you can have. And young consumers are very astute. You cannot lie because you will be caught in a lie. So it's really a truth-telling process.
Well, I was just going to say it's not in anybody's best interest not to accurately portray your institution because you want whoever comes there to have a positive experience.
Absolutely.
And if you attract someone to whom you know this is not going to be a positive experience, it doesn't do anybody any good.
I'm sometimes asked what I do with my summers because they assume I must have my summers off.
No.
When in fact the recruitment cycle is really an 18-month cycle, mm-hmm. And it begins with when students are in their junior year and continues on through the point at which they matriculate at the institution. And so they overlap one another. And the thing that I enjoy most about this business is that it is ever-changing. And I look forward every day to coming to work because I enjoy what I do. And the success to me is in seeing students come into the university, persist on to graduation, and then live fulfilling lives.
Okay, we've had a couple emails that have come in. Let's start with this one. Begins, one of you mentioned that small classes may not be some students' cup of tea. So is your sense that a fair number of students come to IU specifically because they don't like small classes? If so, what percentage of IU students would you guess share that sentiment?
Angela, we could talk about this for 2 hours. I think that some students don't factor small classes into their decisions. Some students want to go to a Big Ten football game. Some people enjoy a large campus life. I went to DePauw, and driving in here today, every time I come to Bloomington, I'm always overwhelmed by the campus vibe. We have a great campus vibe, but it's a different mm-hmm. campus vibe. Mm-hmm. It's a small community, 2,300 students, and So I think that you could probably have a checkbox for 80 different things or 105 different things, and students might check different boxes. Would a student prefer a small class? Probably. But for some students, it's not on the checklist. It's just not on their radar.
And what I would say about Indiana University is that there are incredible opportunities to have the small class experience if that's what you're looking for. I think that when you choose a larger institution, you have to have some ability to go after what you want. And I think that you have to be prepared to make the institution what you want it to be. If you want a much smaller experience, then you live in a living learning center, or you live on an academic floor, or you choose a particular learning environment that's suitable to what it is that you want to get out of your experience. And I think you can do all of that at IU. It's just a question of what you're looking for. And when you look at – I'm not an admissions counselor, but when you look at our average in terms of how many students we have in a given class, I want to say that it's around 20. So it's not huge. Certainly, you might have some larger lecture classes, but you're also going to have much smaller classes too, especially as you proceed down the path of whatever major.
And small classes mean other things too. I chose DePauw coming from Chicago. I wanted to be a broadcaster. I knew I could be on the radio the first day. I looked at other schools and I realized I'd have to wait to be a junior before I could even run the board. And I did actually work in broadcasting before I reformed. Sorry, guys. But I think it's – you decide. I mean, I think that there are some students that really feel the larger campus feels right in their bones when they're there. And there are others that just, you know, the 2,300 students, perfect size. I can do what I want. I can reach out. So it's not to say one's better than the other. It gets back to the individual.
Indiana State University, being a school of about 11,000, frequently we're asked by students who come from small rural high schools about the size issue. And I remind them that at a school of 10 or 11,000, we are really a community of about that size. And like any community, there are neighborhoods within the community. And very frequently, students live in those neighborhoods. And while you may not know everyone in town, you're a part of that community. And we provide all the services that one would normally expect to find in a community of that size. But in fact, after you do break it down into small units, the major in which you are, and beyond the first-year classes, which aren't large at Indiana State in the first place, some of those classes in the sophomore, junior, and senior year get downright small when you're working just with students in your major.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to one more phone call here. John is on the phone. John, thanks for calling into Noon Edition.
Hello. Happy day.
Hi, John.
When I get together with friends in discussion groups, sometimes it comes up that college professors at IU, for example, are making vast amounts of money. And then it turns out that they're not actually teaching the courses. They're getting famous writing books and stuff while their teaching assistants conduct classes. And many of them can't speak English very clearly, even loudly. And so the students are bereft of the wisdom they come to seek out. It's very, very shameful that this can go on. I don't know. In small colleges, it might be the case that not only do you have smaller classes, but you have the professor actually teaching the course, and the kid's learning something from somebody that has some wisdom instead of somebody that's a graduate student from another country that can barely speak English.
Angela, is this a misconception?
Well, there we have it. What happens at smaller schools? Is that really the better thing?
Oh, John, you're asking the wrong guy because I'm wearing my hat over here. But you are right that our professors do teach. That is their role at a college.
You know, I have to admit, I think that there are all kinds of misconceptions in your statement here. I really think that the facts do not indicate that our professors are not in the classrooms. I think that in terms of, you know, some of the language barrier issues, those kinds of things, sometimes that does occur. Of course, just like in life, sometimes that happens. But I don't think that that is the common experience at all.
And I would agree. At a medium-sized university, I know that our faculty teach classes. So I would also agree that that's a misconception.
And I guess I might just piggyback on what Angela was saying. I think one of our roles as institutions of higher learning is to expose students to the world at large. Through study abroad programs, through our increasing numbers of international students, but having people of different cultures in the classroom. We are going to be, especially a generation from now, a much different country than we have been. And that's something I think that we need to celebrate. It's going to happen. There's no changing it. And getting used to people from other cultures and their dialects and everything else is, I believe, an important part of the college experience.
And the last thing I will say, too, about professors is just I don't think that there's a lot of value placed upon what they do outside of the higher education environment. And I don't think that many people understand how much time and energy goes into their occupation, and that it's very important for them to be writing and publishing and researching because that's what makes them qualified to teach in the classroom.
I want to get to one last question here in our last few seconds, and that is, you know, Ken, you said a second ago you were wearing your hat. How hard is it for any of you to go home at night and get away from the university that you spend your time working for and promoting?
I will be the first to say I don't want to get away from it. I live and breathe Indiana University, and I came here as an undergraduate, and I never left. I've worked for the university for almost 10 years. I got 2 degrees from here. And I live in Ellettsville, which is kind of a bedroom community, and yet I spend all of my time in Bloomington going to lectures and to all kinds of wonderful events. So I don't want to get away from it.
I have the same disease. I went to DePauw, and they were the best 4 years of my life. I would come back to campus as often as I could after I worked in television news and had Ponce de Leon moments driving to campus, you know, figuring I was still 18 years old when the rearview mirror I was looking back at told me otherwise. But there is something about being at a place that you love and serving as a champion for that place. So I'm with you. I really don't put it down, and I'm proud that I feel that way.
And I think I have the best job at the university, and I think one of the things that I enjoy most about it is the diversity of experiences that I have. So it's not that I'm just working in an office all day and leave and come back to that the next day. I have great opportunities to interact with business leaders and legislators as well as students and faculty and other administrators. And I just love what I'm doing. In fact, I worked at Indiana State University back in the early 70s and have come back as a result.
John, thanks so much. Thanks all to our guests. Thanks to Mike Pashkash, to Mary Catherine Carmichael, to Ariana Prothero. That has been Noon Edition. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.